Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Vestai Vampyr and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And today we're going to look at the first book of the IKS Gorkon series, A Good Day to Die, by Keith R.A. DeCanado, published in 2003. This book consists of three novels plus one more, and we'll be looking at those over the next few shows. But this is book one. This is the first book. So, John, you got a brief summary plot for us?
And this is going to be more standardized look at the book and then the books later on. A couple of months ago, we did a podcast of the book with the author. And that's a totally different baby because he was telling us more about what went into making the book up, which is an interesting side to see how these ideas go from a casual conversation to an actual published work. But so moving on from the back of the book, the editor's blurb, so to speak, newly inducted into the prestigious Order of the Batleth, Captain Clegg, son of Morak, leads the crew of the Gorkon into the unexplored Karat sector to find new planets on which to plant the Klingon flag. There, they discover the Children of Santara, a species with a warrior culture that rival and perhaps even exceeds the Klingon culture, living on a planet which would be a great addition to the Empire. Clegg could call in General Talak's fleet to bring the world under the Klingon heel, but the Santara offer Clegg a challenge he cannot refuse. The Gorkon crew and the Santara will engage in several martial contests. If the Klingons lose, they will go. They will never trouble the planet again. But if they are victorious, the Santara will cede themselves to the Empire, and Clegg will have single-handedly conquered an entire world. The first tale in a glorious adventure that will be remembered in song and story throughout the Empire.
Yes, and quite a book it is, too.
Actually, what's really nice is that this description, we've talked about in the past, that a lot of the descriptions do not fit the tale you're about to read. This one is spot on.
Yes, it is very good. And it does leave out a couple of details. We'll fill in those holes. But overall impressions, what did you think of this overall?
Well, this is the first book in a series. There are several story references in the book that have taken place in something that happened before this story takes place. It can be considered a standalone novel because it starts out with Clegg going to the planet and his adventures in trying to conquer the planet. And they end with his situation before the events of the next book are going to take place. It shows what life is like on a Vorcha-class Klingon battleship. You know, we've seen some hints at this, whether you have the warriors, the Brek, as they're called in the Klingon culture, awake and training on the ship, like they are in this series, or whether they are popsicles, frozen into stasis, as they are in some books. But this gives us a nice visual of what's going on board the ship. And then there's the children of the Santara. They sound like what the Klingon culture, Klingon society, would have been like had the Herc not invaded, had the Klingons not had their eyes cast to the stars to know that there are enemies out there that could come down and subdue them. They have the innocence that the Klingon people have had torn away from them by the Herc.
Yeah, it's there's a lot there. The Vorcha class ship is the largest at the time in the fleet, isn't that correct?
No. There is a class of at this time, because this is post-Gowron, there is a class of ship, and I'm drawing a blank on what the class is, that is larger than the Vorcha. But for a long time, it was the largest class of ship. It is bigger than the D9 or the Katinga, and has a different armament system. The head that you see in DS9 of the Vorchas is a removable head, because you can put three different modules in place there. Well, not while you're out in space. I'm assuming you have to do it in dry dock. But to do different functions, you can have three different modules in front on this thing. But yeah, it's a pretty big ship.
Yeah, the Vorcha is not the largest. It was the largest. However, the Negvar class of ships is actually larger.
That's the one I was trying to remember.
So, yeah. And the Negvar, those were used in, I believe, in the Dominion War, weren't they?
They came out just before that. Basically, it was a ship the Chancellor of the High Council used.
Okay. So, at any rate, my overall impressions of the book is this is an epic Klingon story, okay? Clagg first appeared in the Next Generation episode where they did the officer exchange with Riker, and Clagg was the first officer, and Riker stepped in, and Clagg was a really great character. And so there was a problem with the captain, and the captain died at some point, and Clagg was elevated to captain. Most Klingons thought that was okay, but there are a few higher-ups that didn't think they liked it. The descriptions in the book of the activity, like the Order of the Batleth ceremony, which we saw in Deep Space Nine, was really, really neat. And the challenges for control of the planet were vivid and believable. When someone describes this book to you without reading it, or I should say, well, they've read it, but it sounds like it could be kind of corny, but no, the writing is absolutely great. So yeah, though, I just thought it was a really great book.
As I was talking with Keith about when we were interviewing him, talking with him about the book, three out of those five challenges are actually done in the Society for Creative Anachronisms.
Okay, neat. What is that Society of Creative Anachronisms?
They were a group of college students. It's broadened out to a lot larger these days. They study medieval history from a tactile point of view, not the on this date this happened that you normally get in history classes, but how do you prepare this meal? How do you brew this particular beverage? How do you fight an attorney?
So basically what you're getting is learning from doing some really deep empirical research.
They're reenactors, yeah, and they're doing it from based on what we can find in the history books, what we can find in textbooks, especially textbooks that we can find of the period. A lot of the brewing information that we have comes from a book that was published during the reign of Queen Elizabeth.
Huh. Sounds like something. That sounds like a neat thing. I wouldn't mind participating in something like that myself. So let's move along and let's talk about, let's just talk about the book itself. Okay. We start out, Order of the Bat'leth ceremony. Clagg gets the Order of the Bat'leth from Martok, who is Chancellor, and a big, huge party, but there's some trouble brewing in the background.
It's just brotherly love.
Yeah. Or maybe some jealousy. I don't know. But at any rate, Clagg has some animosity towards him from his own brother, and also a very high ranking person, a very high ranking Klingon, General Telek, is not and Dorek, who that is Clagg's brother. Yeah, they resent the popularity that Clagg has gained from his accomplishments.
And it has to be that, because even though they're saying they resent him because he took his father's arm, really, that sounds like an excuse to be hating him for deeper reasons.
Well, it seems, and it's covered in the book a little bit, it seems that a Klingon who has scars from battle are not supposed to have those scars healed. They're supposed to show them and be proud of them, and everybody else is supposed to admire the warrior for getting those scars. But for crying out loud, Clagg lost an entire arm in battle, and he was right-handed, so he's having a lot of trouble wielding a Bat'leth.
It is almost impossible to wield a Bat'leth with one hand, mainly because you need both hands to control the torque and swing of a Bat'leth when it is hit.
Uh-huh. And not only that, I don't know if you have a steel Bat'leth, but I do. I have a steel Bat'leth. And you just need both arms, if nothing else, but for balance, because this is a heavy weapon.
I have lots of wooden ones, and at one of the last few Ozfests, I was actually teaching a panel on how to fight with a Bat'leth.
Yeah. So without both arms. So anyway, Clagg has the arm replaced with his father's arm, and there's a lot of people that resent this, apparently.
The problem is, Clagg's father was in a battle with the Romulans and was taken captive, held in prison, and released. Well, you don't do that as a Klingon, but since the Romulans know that, they had a history of hanging on to POWs and releasing them to drive the Klingons nuts in that respect. So his father spent the rest of his life lying around the house, dropped out of the defense force, and waiting to die. Clagg resented his father doing this because he knew his father could not get into Stovacor unless he did so, unless he actually participated in things. So when his father died and he was given the option of, or he thought of the idea of taking his arm, he's using that arm now to give his father enough honor to be able to enter the gates of Stovacor.
Yeah, and that bit that you just talked about is covered briefly in the Next Generation episode with the officer exchange deal. And it was really kind of sad the way the actor portrayed it. You know, I have not talked to my father. He waits to die. Okay. So anyway, was it Clagg's idea to take his father's right arm and have it grafted onto himself, or was that actually Dr. Borak, who thought that would be a good thing?
Dr. Borak had been nagging Clagg to get a mechanical arm to replace his arm so that he could be the warrior that she knew he could be. He's actually the one I believe, who came up with the idea of using his father's arm to both bring him back up to speed and restore his father's honor.
Ah, okay. So anyway, Martok stands up and tells everybody, and this is after the Dominion War, that the Dominion War has depleted Klingon resources, and we need to go out and we need to find sources of, to get things, to build ships and to recover from all that activity for the Dominion War, and sends everybody deeper into the Beta Quadrant to find things. They look for things.
They look for planets and populations to conquer and bring them into themselves. For those of you that aren't, a lot of Klingon culture is kind of based on Roman culture from the point of view of the way you grow your empire is you go out, you conquer a people, you assimilate them into your culture. You now have their lands and the materials that they can make. In Roman times, it was food. For the Klingons, it's the minerals, especially on this particular planet, that they're looking to obtain to increase their own wealth.
Right. But, you know, the Roman Empire, they outstretched their reach, and which is one of the big reasons they fell, is they didn't take care of the resources they had. Rather than exploiting that, they would go farther afield to gather new resources, and they spread out so darn far they couldn't take care of themselves anymore.
Now, it's not typical of Klingons at this time that you'd use the population to improve your war machine, in that all the warriors on a Klingon ship tended to be Klingons. The Klingon Defense Force was made up of Klingons. What would have been interesting to see is if Martok and other members, high-ranking members of the Defense Force, came to this planet and saw the children of Santara as they participated in martial activities, would they have gone ahead and conscripted them into the Klingon Defense Force? Basically, they're above the usual slaves the Klingons have, and they are really, really close to the martial honors and the martial techniques that Klingons prize.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have Martok sending all these ships out farther into the Beta Quadrant, and Clegg, who is in command of the IKS Gorkon, comes upon a planet where there are good resources for shipbuilding, and we need these materials, and this is the planet he's going to choose to conquer, or at least to start to conquer. But things don't exactly go the way they think it's going to. They beam down to the planet, and there is a vicious indigenous race on this planet that call themselves the Children of Santara.
Well, I should say that the Children of Santara are a primitive culture, but they're a primitive culture that has a trained use of edged weapons. And the planet is surrounded by a subspace battle zone with so many disruptions in it that when the Klingons beam down, disruptors don't work. So they have to resort to hand-to-hand combat also. And that puts the Klingons and the Children of the Santara on equal footing. And it becomes a really rough road to hoe. The Klingons didn't give them enough credit in their fighting ability when they made their first incursions into their territories.
Yeah. And now this energy field, is it artificial? I don't remember.
Yes and no. It is a artificial field that is the result of a battle in space using subspace weapons that has destabilized a lot of the space around this planet.
Okay. So members of the Gorkon crew go down to the planet and they discover the children of Santara, who are canine. They're actually canine. Keith said they are wolves, sentient wolves, and they use bladed weapons. And as it said in the description, they are every bit as vicious as a Klingon. And so this makes an interesting thing. We have kind of a standoff situation there, but it would seem that the Gorkon could actually just send down a lot of soldiers, and who knows what the outcome would be.
I forget what the total was. They had like a thousand or more troops.
Yeah, so it would be an interesting battle. But the two leaders get together, Captain Clegg and Malar. Is that Malar, or was it Tayrun?
I think it was Malar.
All right, we'll just go with that. So Malar is the leader of this particular tribe of the children of Santara, and I'm led to believe that there are other tribes in other places. And there's an interesting agreement reached, because rather than all-out war and one side obliterating the other, the Santara seem to have a great deal of respect for life, and they propose to make a deal with Clegg that I never ever thought a Klingon would agree to.
What? Clegg's got the potential of taking this planet without firing a shot. I mean, it's just compete in five competitions. They're Klingons. They should easily win. And he could have all the glory with no losses.
Yeah. But at the same time, he could have just bided his time, stood by, and said, okay, I found this planet that has this mineral on it that we need, and I need the rest of the fleet here. And they'd have been there in a couple of days, and they could have just absolutely obliterated the planet and just taken over.
Actually, they couldn't have been there in a couple of days. They were engaged in a battle that his brother had brought them into, and they're trying to subjugate a planet somewhere else in this sector of space. So it would have taken a little bit of time. And then remember, the general who was in charge of this fleet didn't like Clegg, and therefore Clegg didn't like him. So if he could do it without General Talik's help, he would really love it.
Yes. So what it boils down to is the Klingons are going to choose their best people, and the Santara are going to choose their best people, and we're going to get some challenges. There's a hunt challenge, a hunting challenge, and then a nautical challenge, and then a game of capture the flag, and a show of strength. The strongest warriors from each side have to show their strength. And then finally we have a duel between the commanders. And three out of five wins will take all. So we start out with the hunt.
Which is interesting, because the Klingon who's chosen to participate in the hunt is actually the Klingon from one of the Next Generation episodes that Worf taught to hunt in the Romulan prison camp, now grown up, and he easily brings in the biggest prey.
Yes, that was Tuck. And he's a high-ranking officer on board the ship and has earned his own honor in his own right, and goes out on the hunt and brings back a large, very large animal all alone and wins. Not by a lot, but he edges out the competition and wins that battle.
I keep going through my mind reading those passages, that it had to be harder for him to bring it back, bring it all the way back to the village from where he finally found it and killed it, than it took effort for him to actually find it and kill it. That was one heavy beastie.
Yeah, it wouldn't be one. It wouldn't be something I would want to do. So we have 1-0 for the Klingons. And the next challenge we get is a nautical challenge, using boats to do battle back and forth. And I think I kind of saw the handwriting on the wall before we even started unfolding this story, because Klingons just don't seem to be nautical people.
Let's take it a step further. First of all, did they choose their best person for operating a sailing ship?
I thought they did. A female.
Not originally.
Oh, not originally.
She had to go in and point out to them that she has done this more than anybody else. In fact, it may have been somebody else that went to the powers that be and said, you know, you really ought to put her in charge because she knows what she's doing. And then who were the sailors operating the boat? Officers, commanders, not people that are going to be taking orders rapid fire quickly, but they kind of got in each other's way.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're stumbling over each other because they don't know how things work on a boat, whereas apparently the children of Santara do, and they do quite a bit of boating.
They have an annual hunt for a specific sea creature out there on that ocean, lake, whatever it is that they're bordering. So they're well trained in how to operate a nautical vessel and operate the weapons of their nautical vessels.
Okay. So, yeah. And the Klingons, and probably owing to there only being one continent on Kronos, because there's no need to learn to sail or fish or anything, because everything is right there on the single continent.
Fishing is not a hunt.
No, it isn't. Fishing is relaxation, as far as I'm concerned.
But it can be a hunt, but you have to build certain things first before you can hunt prey in the water.
Right. So we get a tied score after these first two. The Santara win the boat battle. There's some injured Klingons involved with this, and we're 1-1. The next one is capture the flag. And this was an interesting one because we had two teams, and it was just a classic game of capture the flag.
Except when you died, you died.
Yeah, it was serious, and there were some casualties, but
we were introduced to a squad of Klingons under the command of Wol, and she was the one that was placed. She's a 15th squad, so she's all the way down, but she's the top layer. She was the bottom of the top layer of squads. She was put in charge of holding the flag. The two Klingons that we see die in the story are from her squad, but we focus solely on her efforts to hold the ground and keep the flag from being taken. And you're seeing at one point the soldier Breck that she's got as the last line of defense wanting to go out and help his compadres, but she had told him, you stay in this inner circle, you stay by the flag, you do not leave it, you defend it. And it's his doing so that allowed the Klingons to win this particular contest.
And that was Goran that was told to stay behind, correct?
Right.
Who, in the book, seems to be probably the largest member of the crew and also the toughest, and he has never lost a battle, ever.
Never lost a contest. And that's what brings the next one into focus, because it's a strongman competition where all you're going to do, all the two contestants are going to do, is hold this rock up as long as they can. He has never been defeated in anything. He's totally reliant on his strength. He totally idolizes his strength. and he loses the contest by 400 seconds out of 8+ hours.
Yes, which throws him completely for a loop. He is ready to commit mock devour.
And even though his squad leader stops him, it goes around the ship that he's trying to do this because there are certain candles or certain flowers that he needs for the ritual, and they turn up missing. And of course, the only thing that those particular items are used for is this ritual. So the officers realize somebody is going to do this.
Yeah. He just cannot come to terms with the fact that he lost, even though it was by a narrow margin, that he lost this competition. And he's just ready to give up and move on. But you know, he's a valuable member of the crew, and so we don't want to lose him. So there's a lot of effort put into trying to talk him out of this and saying, look, you know, you fought, you did your best, you lost, yes, but it's no reason to give up. And that almost sounds un-Klingon-like.
Well, here's another thing that I think really brings home a point about Klingon philosophy and the way Klingons think about each other. He lost, but he did not bring up as a reason for committing suicide that he lost to a woman. Therefore, Klingon warriors have no problem thinking of men and women as equals.
Oh, yeah. Well, as we find out from Martok, his relationship with his wife, it almost seems to be a matriarchal society at times.
I think you see something similar to that in the episode, The House of Quark, where Grinka is controlling the household after the death of her husband. But her husband was kind of off doing things and not really caring anyway.
Yeah, Grilka, I think was her name. So now we come down to the last battle, and we have a 2-2 tie, and we're going to have a showdown between Melar and Clegg, the two commanders. For some reason, I'm thinking it was Tehrun, but that's neither here nor there.
And a showdown is a gunfight. Two swords is a tourney.
Okay. So throughout the book, much is made, though, that about how Clegg is practicing and working out and trying to regain and get used to the use of his new arm. And he's having a lot of trouble. When he goes in to train, he's finding that it's not responding the way it's supposed to, the way he's used to. And it's putting him at a slight disadvantage. But he's not giving up. He's going to continue to train and strengthen and get back to where he is. But it's a big struggle for him.
It doesn't help that the person he's training with, his personal bodyguard, knows that he has this weakness on his right side. His arm is just a little bit shorter, and it's throwing his balance off. And the bodyguard is compensating for it, probably in the effort to get Clegg to work on it harder. But what it ends up being is that Clegg doesn't see the problem and doesn't do the training needed to overcome the disability he's got, because the person he's training with is just letting him get by with that disability.
Right. So we get into the duel, and it is quite a fight, and it goes on and on and on. It just runs forever, and you don't stop. There's no stopping to rest, and it is to the death. However, we don't get to that point.
No. And an interesting aside here, having been in tourneys within the SCA, the average length of most sword fights is approximately 20 seconds.
Okay. Now that I didn't know. If you believe what you see in the movie,
somebody's got a technique. Somebody's got a technique. The other person hasn't seen. Pulls it out. Use boom. It's over. Most movies, the combatants are trained by the same person. If you look at The Phantom Menace and know that Ray Parks is a martial arts expert, you can see that both characters, the guy that plays Qui-Gon Jinn and the guy that plays Obi-Wan Kenobi, have been trained by the same person, and that's why the fight can keep going on. If you're trained by the same sensei, you know each other's moves, but an attorney, you don't know the opponent's moves. That's why they stand around for a while looking at each other, trying to gauge what the person's going to do.
Oh, that's a neat point of view. Anyway, Clegg loses. And when it's all said and done, the Santara are now 3-2. And Clegg says, I will keep my promise. We will leave and we will never bother you again. And, you know, the Santara almost seemed sad about that happening, because even though they were going to be servants of the Empire when it was all said and done, they wouldn't have been slaves, to speak. I can't remember the word for what their title would be, but they would have been honored. And I think eventually they'd have probably been welcomed in as soldiers with the Klingon crews.
Keith drops hints throughout the whole story of various children of the Santara looking at what the Klingons do, looking at what the Klingons have, looking. In fact, one is even taken up to the ship to be shown how the medical procedures go. And they are starting to admire what the Klingons have, and thinking that, well, maybe if they conquered us, we could start having some of this neat stuff, and it really wouldn't be so bad.
Right. Anyway, it's all said and done. Clegg is going to do the honorable thing, and he calls back to the rest of the fleet, or the rest of the fleet call him, and it's from General Telek, who says, no, you will conquer this planet. We're going to be there in just a little while, and it doesn't matter what promises you made. You have no right to make promises on behalf of the Empire, and you will join us to take this planet over.
I don't remember who the discussion was between, but when that came down, there was a discussion that Clegg is a captain, is a commander of a battle cruiser. And as a captain of a battle cruiser, does have the right to make these agreements for the Empire.
Yes, that is mentioned in the book, that he can make the agreements. And it was an honorable agreement. But there again, see, we've talked about before that maybe honor doesn't extend outside of the Klingon race, that it's mostly considered just between Klingons. But that's not as far as Clegg is concerned. He is going to keep his promise. And so the fleet is on the way. General Telek and Dorek see this as an opportunity to get Clegg out of the way, and this planet is going to be taken over by the Klingons, despite the promise that was made, the legal and binding promise that was made by Clegg.
Well, okay, I have to disagree with you there. It's not a legal promise. It's an honorable promise. You can't have a legal promise unless you have a legal system that's binding to both races.
Okay, well, I'll go along with that. So
it's a technicality.
Okay. Well, and it's also a setup for the next book. So Clegg tells his crew, no, we're going to stand by it, and we are going to fight our own people to make sure that honor is upheld. So we have we get to look forward to a battle amongst Klingons over this planet in the next book.
And it said subspace anomalies that's around the planet to kind of make the odds fair for the Children of the Santara plus the Gorkon versus the fleet that General Talik has.
Yes. Well, and the Klingons or the Gorkon's crew has also been studying this anomaly that evens the odds, and they're starting to discover ways around it.
Which I think they were talking about sending to the general and then decided not to.
Right. Decided not to, which is probably a good thing, because now you have one ship against at least two that we know of, Talik and Doric. And it would be really good for Gorkon to have an advantage. So one of the major concept, again, that seems to flow through all Klingon novels is honor.
And like you say, whether or not that honor is to be doled out to other races or kept solely for Klingon's benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So it sets up the next book, which is Honor Bound, which is called, well, the book in the series is called Honor Bound, Book 2. And we're going to get a fight amongst the Klingons now over this planet. And it all basically boils down to honor and whose honor will prevail. So, John, what are your closing thoughts on this book?
After people have read this book, I think they will ask themselves a question. Why did this particular series of stories stop after just four novels? I think if you go to the other podcast we did with Keith talking about it, you'll see what happened with the publisher and why A Burning House is the last, which was published in 2008, was the last of this particular line of books. Because Keith really does have an interesting set of characters. It's not just Clagg. It's not just Orsatu, the physician. It's not just Torque, the friend of Worf's. We didn't mention, but Worf's brother is one of the officers on the bridge here. So, and it's not just him. It goes deep into the enlisted and their relationship. I mean, you've even got all the way into the mess hall where the crew is trying to scrub the kitchen, scrub the dining hall, sufficient for the next meal. It is a wealth of information that Keith has put together in these books. It is really too bad that he didn't have the chance to keep going.
Absolutely. So I'll tell you what, I really think that while I don't want to take away from the other authors, they're all great and their work is awesome, and it's awesome stuff. But Keith seems to have a little bit of an edge when he writes Klingons, and to me, he makes them really pop. They're really vivid, and he seems to understand them. And I think that's probably because of his martial arts training, for one thing. And he
had to hear about. I said, if you go take a listen to it.
Yeah. So
shameless plug.
That's the one thing I really appreciated was how real these characters are. And then the wealth of characters that we get to see that we have met before that are fleshed out, like Clagg. Leskett is another one. He's probably my favorite character because he's a smart aleck, and he provides a lot of color and a lot of depth to the story just through being a smart aleck. And the doctor, who has had Federation training and is resented for this, although she can do things as a doctor for the Klingon Empire that Klingon doctors can't do themselves. So there's, as you say, John, there is a wealth of knowledge in this book, and it goes very much in depth, and you get a really complete picture of life on board a large Klingon ship.
So I would highly recommend to you, even after listening to this, find the book, find the series of books, and read them. They are well worth the effort.
They really are. So, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think without giving them links to find the books, that's pretty much about it.
Yeah. Well, they are available on Amazon, and I believe they're still available in print. And I would be willing to bet if you absolutely had to go digging for one, I bet Keith would have a copy or two on hand somewhere he'd be glad to sell. So I don't
keep an eye out for it, because Keith does do conventions. You never know where he's going to show up. In the dealer's room, behind a table, selling his books.
Yes. That is, if we ever get conventions up and running again.
We will. A vaccine is coming. And those of us that are willing to take the vaccine will be able to go out and be about.
I look forward to that day. So, as we said, next time we're going to be looking at, next time we'll be looking at Honor Bound, the second book in this series, also by Keith DeCandido. And so for Bound by Honor, I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And join us next time for Bound by Honor. Kapla. You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!